Today, a knot too complex to untie, and that only one knife can cut. The question, problem, conundrum of Psalm 75.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Now, when I say the problem of Psalm 75, we run into the, you know, ambiguity of genitive cases. I don't mean Psalm 75 has a problem with the way it's written or something like that. I mean Psalm 75 addresses a problem that's so fundamental and so important for us to consider. And it's Psalm 75 is not unique. This is the first time I've come to a psalm and said that. It's not unique in its content. It's not bringing up something new or different for us. It is putting all of the fundamental problems that we've been talking about in all of the Psalms in a form that is brief, 10 verses long, and musical, lyrical. That is, it is artistic. You can tell it's appealing. It's something that we could offer up in worship on a regular basis. And yet, underneath it is this really rich and deep and dark complexity of the problem that's actually embedded in the world around us. And so that's what I want us to talk about as we're going through it. So we'll take the first two verses, and I have seen it this way. And this is subjective. I mean, you could put it in whatever context you want to give it a way to be understood. But the division of the psalm is fairly straightforward. Verses 1 and 2, the first two verses, match the last two verses. And they do it obviously. It won't be difficult to see. In the first two verses, we give you thanks, O God, we give you thanks, your name is near, and so on. And in the second verse, at the set time I appoint, I will judge with equity. And when you end the psalm, the psalmist is saying, but I will declare it forever. This is going along with the, we give you thanks, O God, we give thanks. I will sing praises to the God of Jacob in verse 9. And then compared with verse 2, where I will bring about judgment at the appointed time, in the very end, verse 10, he's saying, all the horns of the wicked I will cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be lifted up. So those two, those pairs go together, obviously. So the division of the psalm, the structure of the psalm is really obvious. Verses 1 and 2 make a section, and then verses 3 through 8 make a section, the middle of the psalm, and then the last two verses close out the psalm. So I mean, I'm just following the structure that seems to be obvious in it. Now, how we read that, I'm saying, I give a certain context to so that I have a way of sort of seeing the psalm unfold. So I take the first two verses as a setting. I see them almost like there was going to be a play. How does it unfold? And so I want to talk about the setting. And then in verses 3 through 8, the actual dialogue of the performance itself, you know, the things that create the interaction that make it so dramatic. And verse 2 really begins the dialogue. I know that. But I think verses 3 through 8 are the real content of what we're supposed to see. Verse 2 sort of introducing it. And then, like I said, verses 9 and 10 giving a conclusion. So we'll take it in those three pieces. And so if you look at the first two verses, the statements that I read to you just a moment ago, they are this. Now, this is after the superscript, obviously, to the choir master according to Do Not Destroy. In the modern translations that I read, that single Hebrew word is translated. And it means do not destroy, and it is most likely just a heading that says use that rhythm, use that tune that went with those psalms that use this same structure. So it's, you know, according to this tune or something. But, you know, the tune's name could be associated with the meaning of the Psalms. And when we were looking at this in previous Psalms that had the title, they were particularly fitted. They were well fitted to the idea of a psalmist praying, to the congregation praying, for God to pay attention to what was happening with them and not to allow them to be destroyed. So it's possible that that could add some context to this for us. I think it probably does add some. It does not read, though, as a psalm of desperation. It does read where there's a problem. You're going to see it in just a moment. But it does not read in the same way as we've just seen the temple destroyed, and now what will you do to preserve us? It doesn't read like that. But it does read as a psalm that needs God to intervene. And so we will talk about how that is in just a moment. So according to Do Not Destroy, a psalm of Asaph, a song. And here's how it goes, starting in verse 1. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks, for your name is near. We recount your wondrous deeds. And then in verse 2, at the set time, and this appears to be a quotation from God. I say that. It is. It obviously is, as we get further into the psalm. But even as you begin to read it, you think, oh, we've changed voices here, because there was the congregation singing together. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks, for your name is near. We recount your wondrous deeds. And then Yahweh responding, at the set time that I appoint, I will judge with equity. So those two verses provide a setting for us so that we can understand what's going to happen in the rest of the psalm. The first verse, the setting, obviously one of gratitude. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks. There is a repetition of that phrase that makes it emphatic. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks. So there's gratitude. And then the statement, because your name is near. So there is in that statement a certain amount of faith, a certain amount of confidence that God is going to take care of them and that they have a reason for giving him thanks right now. Your name is near. So there's a faith in the context of the confidence that we have that God will take care of us. And then the final statement of verse 1, we recount your wondrous deeds. And this is a part of why we practice, you know, I'll use the word, and I mean it broadly, not in a very narrow denominational type of sense. It's why we have liturgy. We want things to be passed down from one generation to the next. And in the congregation of Israel in particular, and just think about the covenant being established with them, when God gives them the Shema, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, when he declares that he is one, he is their only God, he also tells them, and then take all of these commandments and bind them on your forehead, on your gateposts, and talk to them with your children, and every day repeat them, and so on. He's saying all of that because the community needs to be established in this faith. And so the third part that I would give to verse 1, in addition to the gratitude that comes from having a God and the faith and confidence that we have in him, is the faith that we mean, the other use of the word faith that we have, which is the practice of our beliefs, how we apply it. And in this case, that practice, meaning our faith, not the body of doctrine, but the way we live in community because of our faith, the Baptist faith, the Christian faith, that kind of statement. In this case, the Jewish faith is not just a list of doctrines, it's a community of which they're a member. And so lifting up their voices together and saying, we recount your wondrous deeds, is not simply reflexive. It's not simply recounting the deeds so that I myself in my prayer closet can be encouraged in my own stress. It is so that in this community, everyone is reminded of the faithfulness that God has demonstrated. And so our faith is strengthened, not simply in my own heart being encouraged by remembering what God did last week for me, but our community's faith is strengthened by remembering what God has done for the entire congregation, which we are celebrating together. It's part of why we participate in liturgies together. There's a certain amount, there's a sort of resurgence of interest in elements in worship services right now that are shared across congregational lines. When I was young in ministry, every man did what was right in his own eyes, in the sense of the judges. Every church just did their own thing. Now it has become much more common for congregations to have shared elements. And so from one church to the next, and I go to a lot of different churches, I find it fascinating how many churches, especially those being pastored by younger leaders, share similar elements, a prayer of confession and a repetition of a creed of some kind, or an acknowledgement of a confession of faith of some kind, and shared songs and just the elements of the service that, in some ways we used to think were too formal for Baptists. And maybe in your denomination it's the same way. Maybe there's a reversion to it. Maybe your denomination's moving the other direction. I don't know. But that element that you can go from one setting to the next, but whether you're in this village or that village, in this church or that church, and in this case, in this synagogue or that synagogue, you share the same faith because you tell the same stories. And obviously, in our own Christian faith, the thing that ties us together in that commonality of narrative is Scripture. That's the uniting ingredient beyond all. And so we give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks for your name is near. We recount your wondrous deeds. So we have gratitude and a confident faith and a practiced faith, a faith that we view as being a part of our heritage and something we want to hand down to those who follow us, and it's a part of our community. So gratitude and faith as the elements in verse 1. And then the second, so I'm establishing all of that to say we have in our faith this optimism is the wrong word, but this brightness, this upside to the whole range of human attitudes that are available to us, we have this very positive side to it that comes with our faith and its practice. And then you have verse 2, and God responds not accepting the compliment, oh, well, you should be grateful. I mean, look what I've done for you. But instead with something of a promise, right? So at the set time that I appoint, I will judge with equity. And equity is the word that means level. I will judge in a way that, just like the scales that you would use measuring things out in a marketplace, he's saying, I am going to judge things with equity. I am going to use an even scale. I am going to bring things to level, and you'll understand why I'm saying those words as we get further into the psalm, why the level aspect of equity is so important. At the set time that I appoint, I will judge with equity. And the elements in this one are starkly contrasted with the elements of verse 1. So in verse 2, it's at the set time that I appoint, there is a delay. And in this case, it is an acknowledgement that our gratification is going to be delayed. We want that equity now. We want to give thanks to God for making things equitable, for making things right. And yet it's not there yet. And so at the set time that I appoint means we experience delay, so a delayed gratification. And at the same point, he says, I will judge with equity. Now, tenses aren't the same in Hebrew. So you can translate this a number of different ways, but there's no way throughout this psalm not to recognize the as yet unfulfilled nature of this promise from God. There's something we want to see that we haven't seen yet. And yet what we express in verse 1 is that his name is near. Your name is near. It's here right now. And yet he's saying, well, I will judge. It will come. And so there's a contrast in our experience having to do with the promise that God is making. And then finally, I will judge with equity, meaning something needs to address this inequity that's in the world right now. That acknowledgement of inequity is starkly in contrast with our practice of our faith, where we're already acknowledging the shared community that we have both with our ancestors and those who will follow us and the fact that the faith that we have is not just about us, but those who are around us. And so we got this beautiful shared community, and yet an acknowledgement that things are not equitable yet. Things are not right yet. And I'm bringing those things up, not because you would always read the first two verses of Psalm 75 and immediately go to the tension between verses 1 and 2, but I think in an honest place in the world where we are aware of what all of these psalms have been saying, all the way down through, this is the end of the first half of the psalms in terms of pure numbers, not dividing it by books or formal divisions or anything like that, but you know, there are 150 psalms. We're on Psalm 75. Halfway through this psalm, you know, it leaves us in a position where if we've been paying attention to the other psalms, we would have to say, wow, there is an inherent tension between what we want on one side, and I'm going to say it this way, and then I'll explain that it's way more significant than this and much broader, more comprehensive than what I'm saying right now. But there is an inherent tension, and I know I use that word a lot, inherent. I can't avoid it. I mean, it comes with the world. It is built into the nature of the world. It is congenital with the world. There is an inherent tension between, in one expression of it, what we want and then what we actually experience. And it's I had a tragic experience the other day. It's traumatic. I was driving my truck. I'm driving 35 miles an hour because that's the speed limit and that's what I always drive. And these three squirrels were playing in the street. And, they're way, way, way off in the distance. And I know they can see me coming because they're starting to dart back and forth in the middle of the lane. And they have plenty of time to get out of the way. So I'm starting to slow down and give them a little extra time. But it's like, the closer I get to them, the more I realize they're just going to be darting back and forth right up until the last second. And so I'm trying to slow down even more. And unfortunately, one of them did not make it out of the street. I find that troubling. It disturbs me. I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't care. I should be uncaring. I should be immutable. It doesn't bother me, but it does. It bothers me. But it's also like, come on, man, just pick a direction. Just go. Why on earth wouldn't you just go? In the same sense, I'm like, why on earth are all these caterpillars crossing the street right now? What does a furry black caterpillar imagine they're going to find on the other side of a busy street? What are you going to do over there that you couldn't do where you were? I don't understand that at all. Or a turtle. Why are turtles crossing the street? And when that happens, by the way, I've gotten off my bike and picked up a turtle and carried it to the other side of the street. And then I thought to myself, a half mile down the road, I wonder if that was the side he actually wanted to go to, because I can't ever tell whether he's been turning around in the middle of the street trying to get somewhere else. I don't know where he's trying to go. I'm sharing those for this reason, because we are in this tumultuous place where we want to look up and say, oh, thank you, God, for making things so beautiful. And we're commanded to do that. Give thanks for everything. Everything. And then we open our eyes and look around and say, I'm supposed to give thanks for that? I mean, do you see what's happening, God? And you're telling me I'm supposed to give thanks for everything? So I turn this way and it's like, I'll go where you want me to go. And I'm running headlong into being grateful for inequities, for injustices, for evils in the world. And I think to myself, I'm not going that way. I'm turning around and going this way. I'm going to go the other direction. And so I'm going to point out the things that are wrong in the world. And then we become these skeptics or cynics who don't believe God's ever going to make anything right. We wander around the road till we just get run over by our own skepticism, by our own doubt. And I'm just trying to make the point that a psalm like this refuses to allow us to be shallow in our way of coming at the world, in our way of seeing it. We can't pretend we're not standing in the middle of the road right now. We can't pretend people don't get run over. They do. But we also have a reason to believe that the other side of the road is better, that there is a reason that we're going to the other side of the road. And that's what this psalm brings to us again. And again, it brings it not in something long and complex, but something very direct. And it's direct in a way that ought to change the way we think about the world. And yet, as I look at Christianity that I've been just buried in for 60 years, as I look at the form of the Christianity that we carry, I don't think we pay attention to the content of the most direct address to this problem that we have in a psalm like this. I just don't think we pay attention to it. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 3 years. I've been just trying to say over and over and over again, we have to pay attention to this because that's what the Bible demands of us. So if I start in verse 3 in the dialogue. So I said in verses 1 and 2, we have a setting. And the setting is this tense place where we exist between the gratitude we have for the fact that God's name is near, that we can call on, that our faith is real, and the reality of what we experience in a world that needs someone to come and judge it. And we believe they're going to come and judge it. That's part of us having our faith. But we also know they haven't yet, which is part of why we have faith, because it hasn't happened yet. So in that setting, we have this dialogue that begins. And I say dialogue not because it's an interchange like you would think of in a play, but because God is speaking clearly, and then there's a response to that as well that adds into it. And so what's the dialogue do for us? So first, there's in verses, and this is all in verses 3 through 8 in the psalm. In the first three verses of that, verses 3 through 5, you have this statement about what the future's judge, the one who said, I will judge with equity in the time that I appoint, that future judge is doing something. And one of the things that he's doing is in verses 3 through 5, which is he's just staying involved. So the characteristic we most easily assign to God, that we know most clearly about his being, and I say that not we as evangelicals, not we as Christians, but we as human beings, just existing, just by existing in a world that we know is greater than we are, we all have this sense that there was someone who created the world. And the scriptures themselves say that. I think nature itself testifies to that. And even for people who deny it later, they start out in a position where they think somebody else made this world, and then they figure out a way not to believe in that anymore. So I'm saying it's basic to us that we think of God being the creator. What's not basic to us is to realize that the one who created the world stays involved in it. And so for God's response in this setting where we have an inherent tension between what we want and what we experience, what we want being a God we can be grateful to for his involvement in our lives and in our community, what we experience is a God who's not as active in that as we want him to be, well, then obviously the first thing this psalm is going to address in its dialogue is the fact that the creator, the God who created us and we want to be grateful to, actually is still involved in the world. So he's not just a creator, he's a sustainer as well. And the word I would use for this is actually maintainer, but we have the wrong concept when we hear that word, like he's going to do a minimal, you know, I'll spray some WD-40 on it and keep it going, you know, put some duct tape where things are falling apart, but I'm not going to really fix it up, I'm just going to maintain it. But that's not what I mean. And sustainer, I think, conveys the idea better, that he's constantly, actively, still involved in the world that he created. It's very hard for us to remember that for reasons I've talked about in plenty of other episodes. It's the reason we think of a miracle as God somehow deciding to get involved in the world again and do something finally, which is an absurd definition of the miraculous on the basis of how Scripture describes God's involvement in the world constantly, because he's constantly as active in the world as he was in Genesis 1:1, bringing about its existence. So he is staying involved. So what do I mean by that? Starting in verses, and again, this is in verses 3 through 5, starting in verse 3. So he says, when the earth totters, and again, we could read this futuristically, and I think it's ambiguous. There is a little implication about the future, But I don't think that's where it's supposed to stay. And so I like this translation, the ESV's translation, because it makes this pretty clear. And so it says, when the earth totters and all its inhabitants. So we can read that as, you know, all these times when you look over there in the Middle East and the earth is shaking, when you look at Ukraine and the earth is shaking, whenever you see these places of trouble, that when the earth totters and all its inhabitants, even if it were the entire world, it is I who keep steady its pillars. That's a really powerful and beautiful image. I didn't just set the earth in motion and then just hope it would stay balanced. When you see the earth shake, you should know my hand is underneath it, stabilizing it, fixing its pillars, shoring it up. So when the earth totters and all its inhabitants, it is I who keep steady its pillars, Selah. So the question is, and what we're left with here is, and I was giving you random examples a moment ago, you know, when we're having war in the Middle East, or I could have said when the economy collapses, or when there's a pandemic, or whatever. I could pick any random thing, right? We don't know what the earth tottering means unless we ask the next verses. So what does he mean by that? And that's the question. You know, what is it that makes God look at the earth and say, no, 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 that's shaking off of the foundation that I built it for? That is not what I want in it. And that would tell us what's not righteous, what's not the way the earth is supposed to be, right? So the question is, what makes it look to God like it's tottering? And his response makes perfectly clear what that is. He says it in verses 4 and 5. I say to the boastful. So this is God putting up his hands to the pillar and saying, no, let's get things back the way they're supposed to be. I say to the boastful, do not boast. I say to the wicked, don't lift up your own power, your own horn. Do not lift up your horn on high or speak with a haughty neck. You know, this, the answer that God gives to the question, well, what would make the earth totter, is inequity. The powerful being exalted. Now look, I'm reading the scriptures. I had to do this for decades before I would finally stop explaining away things it clearly says on the face of it. His answer to the question of what is shaking the earth, making it fall off the foundation that God created it to be on, is when the powerful are exalted. When there is inequity. And why does he always, so think about it. Think about it in the New Testament and in the Old Testament, how consistently and constantly God is promising to humble the exalted and to exalt the humbled or the abased. And the answer, it's as simple as it can possibly be, because he wants equity. I was thinking the other day, and I of course I believe in, you know, I want you to understand the nature of what I'm about to say before I say it. When David Hume wanted to be a skeptic and wanted to express his skepticism in the most powerful way possible and say, there cannot be miracles. Miracles don't make any sense at all. As an empiricist, he gave this great famous, when I say great, I mean excellent, logical, famous proof that a miracle could not be, that it doesn't make any sense for us to think in terms of miracles happening. What he really needed to get at was denying the ability to deny the miracle of the resurrection. And so it became all about that, because the one miracle in Christianity is the resurrection. So I know that. I know how important it is, and I believe in it. Absolutely. I love the miracle of the resurrection. So I'm going to say this in a spoofing kind of way, and I just didn't want anybody to make a mistake in hearing me incorrectly. It's a shame when you have to explain your statements before you make them, especially if they're ironic in some way. But this is the case. I mean, I'm seriously baffled to the point of expressing it like this. The real miracle of Christianity happened when we read the Bible and concluded that our calling was to protect the powerful and the wealthy from the threat of the needy and what they might bring. Now, you can wonder, what on earth does he mean by that? That we read the Bible and concluded our calling was to protect the powerful. You can go back and listen to previous episodes about what conservatism is, what it means for us to be conservative, and the inherent nature of being a conservative. And I've been a conservative my whole life, so I understand what it means to be a conservative. But to use our Christianity for the sake of protecting those who already have positions of privilege or power, they may not use them in an evil way at all, by the way. I'm not saying that like there is an inherent danger in having wealth or something, or an inherent evil, that is, in having wealth or something. There probably is an inherent danger, but there's an inherent danger in a lot of things. My point is simply for us to read this book, the one I'm looking at, and as I'm looking at this psalm right now, for us to read this book and conclude that God has called us to protect the powerful, that's a miracle. That's a miraculous way to read a text. That's accomplishing something. Because clearly, as God looks at the world, and he says, man, something's gone wrong in my world, the measure of that in this psalm is that the wicked are boasting and lifting up their horns, the evidence of their power, even higher, and as they do, speaking with pride, with confidence about their position in life or in society. And so in verse 6, he goes on to say this in the dialogue, establishing things in the right order. Verse 6, "For not from the east or from the west, and not from the wilderness comes lifting up." Now, the idea in that statement in verse 6 is that for us, it does look like people come from the east with great power. And if you put this in the context of the city being besieged, then you would understand, oh, power has come from the east, from those great kings on the other side of the river. Or power has come from the sea, where the Phoenicians are establishing this mighty, you know, commercial kingdom. We can see power coming from Egypt, from anywhere, from the wilderness down toward Egypt. So this is how we see the world. That person has power. Look at their wealth. That person has power. Look at their connections. And so God says, not from the east or from the west does power come. That's not where lifting up happens. It's premised on the fact that it looks right now like those who are lifted up are also the ones who are doing the lifting up. You know, they've lifted themselves. They've exalted themselves. Everybody wants on their coattails, lift me up with you. Please endorse me so that I can be the next candidate. People do it on both sides of the political spectrum. Everybody lives there. If you're around the wealthy and, you know, all of us who are in higher education or in any kind of nonprofit world, we are around the wealthy because they have resources they want to use to do good. And so we're saying to them, hey, we're doing something good. If you're interested in helping here, we would love to have your help. So I'm around wealthy people like that all the time. It is funny the difference between those who come to the wealthy simply to say, look, if you want to do something good with your resources, here's an opportunity for you to do something good. And those who are looking at them as their only hope for the future. And it's a huge difference. And it's the same as the difference between those who are wealthy and are saying, man, I have been blessed. I am stunned at how good God has been to me. And I want to distribute that. I want to just do whatever I can with it to help people. And those who look at themselves as being elite, look how much better I am than all these other people. I mean, I guess I can be kind and help some of them because they need the help. I mean, just look at them. They don't have my intelligence. You can tell the difference between them. I'm blessed to be around a lot more of the former than the latter. And I'm very grateful for that, by the way. So anyway, the point here is that God is reminding us that the things that look powerful in the world are not the things that create power in the world. And they're not the things that can keep that power. So our tendency to look to them for help is based on our presumption that they actually are the distributors of power. And when we do that, and then there's someone evil who's distributing that power, well, then that's why we question whether God is paying any attention. God, I mean, look at the people who are crooked and yet they're blessed. They have abundance. They have power. Why is this happening? That question doesn't even need to be raised if we're already aware that they can't maintain their power, that it doesn't come from them to begin with. So in verse 6, he addresses one part of it. In verse 7, he goes on to say in the positive side, you know, verse 6 is the negative side. Well, it's not coming from the east or the west or the wilderness. But in verse 7, but it is God who executes judgment, putting down one, lifting up another. Now, it doesn't always look like that right now. Sometimes it does. We get to see sometimes where God intervenes and makes things right. And that's an encouragement and a blessing, and we hope that we get to see more of it all the time. We don't always get to see that because it doesn't always look that way right now. That's the premise in verses 1 and 2. But what is happening right now is that God is always actively involved, even when it's not looking like he's making everything right. So he's already doing what he will do, which will be evident in that future judgment. So that's what verse 8 is getting at. For in the hand of the Lord, there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it. This is happening now. And again, the tenses are not as clear in Hebrew, so I'm not saying this is the only way to read it, but I think it is a reasonable way to read it, and I think it's what we're supposed to sense in the telling of this, in the singing of this psalm. In the hand of the Lord, there is already a cup with foaming wine, well mixed. This wine is always representation. I say always, but it's constantly, it's repeatedly a representation of this injustice that's been done, the blood that's been spilled. And so the wine that's foaming and well mixed, I mean, it's been there, and it is spiced. It's prepared to be consumed. It's not fresh and, oh, I need to decide what to do with this. It's waiting to be consumed. And so he pours out from it. He's doing that now, but eventually all the wicked of the earth will drain it down to the dregs. And I don't have time to dwell on this time, but we've talked about it in previous episodes as well. You know, the image in throughout Scripture is this. From the moment of Abel's blood crying out from the ground, remember when God confronts Cain? Is your brother's blood not crying out to me from the ground? From the moment Abel is killed, his, in image, his blood spills into the ground, and the earth becomes fuller and fuller of that blood. That's one metaphor about it, the image. Every person who dies, their blood pours into the ground, and the earth stores it up until there's finally a judgment of all that unjust death. The other image of it is that each time that blood is poured into the ground, an equivalent of wrath, of God's wrath, is filling this cup or this bowl that he is holding, and that he holds that vial, that blood, that cup or bowl of his wrath until the day of judgment in the third trumpet that's blown or the seals that are broken, when he pours out his blood on the earth. And in pouring out that blood, and these are the bowls of his wrath in Revelation 16 that I'm describing, when he pours out that bowl of his wrath on the earth, that's when the rivers and the streams, they're turned to blood. He's not pouring out blood, he's pouring out his wrath. That image throughout all of Scripture is carried from Abel to Noah through Moses with the children in Egypt and the river turning to blood. It's the avenger of blood in the book of Numbers. It's David's guilt, his hands so covered with blood that he can't build the temple, even though he is the messianic figure in the Old Testament. And then finally, what I was giving you in Revelation 16, that bowl of God's wrath poured out. This is what verse 8 is appealing to for all of us to say, you know, I know it looks like God is simply waiting right now, but he's not. He is filling up his cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and ready to pour it out into the earth so that the wicked drink every drop of it when he brings his judgment to the world. So his activity now is what he's describing, even though we don't see the end of that judgment in this current moment. So in the last two verses, finally, the conclusion of the matter, we hear this. And it is, by the way, in a slight contrast with the first couple of verses, instead of, well, I'm giving you thanks now, even though things don't look right now, it is a declaration that becomes eternal. The gratitude we're expressing now will be something we can carry forward permanently in verse 9, as I'll read it to you in just a moment. And then in verse 10, this assurance from God that the judgment that he's storing up right now will one day really be poured out. So in verse 9, but I will declare it forever, this eternal praise. I will declare it forever. I will sing praises to the God of Jacob. That is, I don't have to abandon verse 1 because God is living up to my gratitude. He is living up to the promise that his name is near, even when I can't always see it. And so because I don't have to abandon it and God is living up to it, God will prove faithful in his judgment. My praise will last forever, so I will declare it forever. And then in verse 10, all the horns, the power, the raising up that they experience now, all the horns of the wicked, I will cut off. But the horns of the righteous, they'll finally be lifted up. That is, power is removed. I'm cutting off the horns of the wicked. And power is also revealed, because the real source of power is able to lift up those who had been humiliated before. I'm not going to take time to read the whole account to you, but this is what's happening in Luke 16. It's not just one person getting vengeance on somebody who was selfish. In Luke 16, the story of the rich man and Lazarus lying at his gate, and the fact that Lazarus dies and the rich man dies and so on. You know, remember how all of that comes to bear in the judgment when the rich man is calling out for mercy. And Abraham's answer is, child, remember that in your lifetime, you already had all of your good things. And Lazarus, in like manner, bad things. But now he's comforted here and you are in anguish. That's an expression of exactly the same thing, just without the elevations, right? It's not about up and down. It's about those who have, excluding those who have not right now. And God making that right, so that those who are above are brought down and those who are below are lifted up. So here are the things I would hope that we would take away, right, from Psalm 75 regarding the world, that we would see that the nature of the world is that mountains and valleys segregate us. They shape the world inevitably into these inequalities. And again, I'm not even saying they're all evil. I'm just saying it's the nature of the world. How would it not be that way? We don't all live in the same places. We don't all speak the same language. We don't all have the same economies. We can't all drive the same car. And I mean that literally, like that car over there. It's not possible. We can't all fit. So some people walk and some people run and some people drive a Toyota and some people are stuck with a Ford. That's a joke. I have a Ford. So it's all good. I'm not actually being critical of Ford. Please don't email me about that. Email me about other things, but not about that. My point is, even in the ways that we see it as innocuous, the reality is that the mountains and valleys that exist in the world by its nature inherently segregate us and shape the world into inevitable inequalities. And for us, that means something. It means we can address one inequality, but acknowledge that even when we're doing that, we might be creating, and we will be creating, another inequality. It's still worth doing, by the way, because we're remaining aware of our wrongs and we're trying each time to take a step toward the righteousness God desires to see in the world. But we can acknowledge that we're not ever going to make everything perfect in the world because it's filled with mountains and valleys that are bigger than we can make level or plain. In the church, I'll say this, a takeaway for us. As part of the body of Christ, I think we should think about this. If our churches are constantly pontificating about a set list of moralistic issues, which sometimes are topics in Scripture and actually can be important. Gender, sexuality, abortion, family values, all of those things we've talked about for decades in our particular branch of the movement. I mean, mine. If we do all of that, and we pontificate about those things all the time, but never lift up our voice, we never reach the crescendo of amens about the inequalities that exist in power, wealth, comfort, or security that have defined human existence since Cain used his power to kill Abel, then we probably need to turn our question away from heaven and toward our own inexplicable application of what heaven reveals to us in 1189 crystal clear chapters about our own moral bankruptcy and spiritual dearth. What are we thinking? So we have some self-analysis to do in light of this psalm. And then for everyone, for all of us in this world, I would say most of the time we spend for our own benefit, we should be aware of, is time we're using to contribute, not maliciously, not always maliciously at least, but time we're using to contribute to the inequalities and injustices that do permeate history. I mean, it's just part of human nature. We're struggling for the same piece of bread, and I don't believe in a limited economy like that. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying the way we approach things, if I can't buy that, he will. I don't want him to, so I'm going to compete for it. And in that competitive mode that we adopt, we're sort of contributing more to the mountains and less to the valleys, and so creating even more inequalities. And in a takeaway regarding God, then finally this, to acknowledge that he is paying attention to the mountains and the valleys, so that when Jesus came, he began to make the rough places plain, to lift up every valley and to make every mountain and hill low. And when he comes again, he will make all of the rough places plain. He will lift up every valley and make every mountain and hill low. Psalms like this one remind us to see our role in creating the inequalities God sees in the world, to stop making those inequalities worse, and to trust that the only one who can really make it right, like permanently, he will. So our faith is in him. His name is near. Our faith is in him, and our lives change because of it.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.